Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arrests of two men charged with the death of U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sitnik, who died during the assault on the Capitol by Trump supporters on January the 6th, both of whom sprayed Officer Sitnik in the face at close range with what one of them called bear bleep from a canister containing an unknown chemical. Eitan Goldman, a former federal prosecutor who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York and helped build the case around the Oklahoma City bombing, joins us to discuss the work he did back then with the Justice Department against white nationalist terrorists, along with Merrick Garland, who is now the Attorney General. We will discuss how Merrick Garland has prioritized the building of cases at the DOJ against some of those who stormed the Capitol based on mountains of video evidence and a flood of tips from the public. We'll also assess when we might be able to expect public trials in which those who consider themselves patriots who were following orders from their president will be convicted as murderous thugs and jailed as criminals. Then we'll examine what Stacey Abrams calls the racist Republican voting suppression underway as Jim Crow in a suit and tie, and focus on the more than a dozen GOP-sponsored bills under consideration by the Texas legislature to impose more ID requirements and limit early voting under the fig leaf of voting integrity. Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republicans at the state and national level, joins us to discuss how the GOP no longer wants to compete, but instead plans to cheat as the Republican Party abandons democracy in an authoritarian push to grab power. Then finally, we'll look into the Protecting the Right to Organize PRO Act, which passed the House last Tuesday and faces a filibuster in the Senate. Lane Wyndham, Associate Director of Georgetown University's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor and co-director of Will Empower, that's Women Innovating Labor Leadership, and author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide, joins us to discuss how the PRO Act impacts efforts underway to unionize the anti-union behemoth Amazon and how Americans like unions, but only 10.7% of the workforce belong to them. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Eitan Goldman, who's a former federal prosecutor who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York and helped build the case around the Oklahoma City bombing. He is currently a trial lawyer who focuses his practice on white-collar criminal defense, securities and commodities litigation, and complex commercial litigation. And he also served as the director of the Division of Enforcement of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eitan Goldman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And obviously, if you worked on the Oklahoma City bombing case, you worked with the new Attorney General, Merrick Garland. So there's been a number of stories in the press suggesting that Merrick Garland is perfectly suited to be the new Attorney General in terms of prosecuting those responsible for the January 6th assault on the Capitol. Do you think he's the right man for the right job?
I do. I think he is the attorney general we need for this moment in U.S. history, not just because of the Capitol riot and the threat of domestic extremism, but also because of how the Department of Justice has been politicized in the last 4 years and having Merrick at the helm, I think, is inspired choice to kind of return the DOJ to its previous reputation and reality for being impartial and following the facts and the law. So I think he's the right person for that reason. And I do think that his experience in supervising the Oklahoma City investigation will be useful. I know that for everyone involved, it was a formative experience. And I think that that's something that he will bring to the job in terms of focusing on the Capitol insurrection and other kind of threats going forward from violent right-wing extremists.
Well, apparently he's already had, I think on his first day, he had briefings on where the trial stand. Former U.S. Attorney for D.C. was in charge. And before Merrick Garland showed up, the Biden administration put in an acting U.S. Attorney for D.C., which would indicate perhaps that they weren't necessarily happy with the holdover from the Trump administration. What's your understanding of where the investigations are? Because today, two men were arrested and charged with assaulting U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sitnik, who died as a result, it would seem, of the fact that these two characters had a canister of what they call bear. I can't use the second word on the air. And it's an unknown chemical. And it would seem that this toxic chemical sprayed directly into Officer Sitnik's face, along with a couple of other Capitol policemen, might well have caused his death. So, what's your understanding of the kind of scope and pace of these investigations? Have they picked up since Merrick Garland showed up?
I mean, I don't have any inside information about that. All I know is what I, read in the press and the pleadings. But when you talk about this investigation, I think you need to kind of separate it out into different genres. I mean, the whole investigation is a enormous, sprawling investigation that is consuming a lot of resources, a lot of person hours, a lot of analysis. There's, I'm sure, thousands of interviews going on and analysis of social media accounts and search warrants being served. So I think that it's probably a pretty enormous undertaking. And, so was the Oklahoma City investigation. I mean, the FBI in that case interviewed more than 25,000 people. So there's no question that Merrick has experience in overseeing a huge investigation. I assume that there'll be, a bunch of people in between him and the actual people on the ground in this investigation. But when you divide these cases into genres, I mean, you have hundreds of people that have been arrested, and there are going to be hundreds of more, it looks like, for relatively minor crimes, trespassing, and just the people who are there in the Capitol. I mean, their very presence there is all the evidence you need to convict them of a crime, and a lot of them are on, social media and different videotapes. So you're going to have hundreds of people who plead guilty and are sentenced to, probably, if any jail time, probably relatively little jail time. And then you have the kind of cases that you see with the Oath Keepers, where they're going to try to build conspiracy cases with people who are a little bit more organized, who maybe planned to storm the Capitol, who came to D.C. to do that. And those are going to be more serious, and those are going to, have more serious charges and potentially lead to more jail time, and they're going to take a lot longer to develop. And then the third genre is if you have evidence of that, of people who not only were they in the Capitol, not only did they breach the Capitol, not only did they destroy property, but they physically attacked federal law officers, and some of them actually ended up killing them. That's a whole nother classification of case, because I think those people will be pursued rightly very aggressively, and they'll, especially if they can make charges of murder of a federal law enforcement against any of those people, that crime carries the death penalty. And I'm not saying that the Department of Justice would necessarily seek the death penalty in this case, but if they are able to make that kind of charge stick, I think that whoever did that probably can look forward to spending the rest of his life in prison or very close to that.
And of course, Timothy McVeigh was sentenced to death in the Oklahoma City bombing. You mentioned Eytan Gulman, you mentioned the Oath Keepers. The head of the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers was in his indictment. He was responding to President Trump's invitation for a big protest on January the 6th. It's going to be wild. And he wrote on his Facebook page, "Trump says it's going to be wild," with lots of exclamation points. "It's going to be wild," lots of exclamation points. "He wants us to make it wild," in caps. That's what he's saying. "He called us to the Capitol and wants it to be wild. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Gentlemen, we are heading to D.C. Pack your bleep." So I guess they're getting into social media. They've got God knows how much video, you know, from the CCTV cameras in the Capitol itself and all of the people with their cell phone videos. And I believe citizens are weighing in with lots of tips. And, of course, the one of the officers who's badly beaten and they threatened to kill him with his own gun, he had his badge ripped from him, and that showed up in the backyard of somebody who'd buried it in the backyard, and he was arrested. So it looks like the FBI is doing a pretty thorough job. What's your impression, Eitan Goldman?
It looks like they're devoting a lot of resources to this. I think that, you know, Chris Wray, the director of the FBI, has been pretty clear that they're taking this very seriously and that they are going to, you know, do whatever they can to, you know, catch and punish the people responsible. You know, when you talk about Trump and you read the posts of the head of the Oath Keepers talking about being called to D.C. and Trump saying it's going to be wild, I mean, there is, in my mind, no question that Trump is responsible for this violence. I mean, he lied for months and months and months about election fraud, about this election being stolen. He, you know, incited people by social media on the morning of. He, you know, continued his incitement along with, you know, Don Jr. and Rudy Giuliani. And I've heard a lot about, you know, whether or not those people can be criminally prosecuted. And, you know, even though it is crystal clear that Trump is responsible for this, and even after it started happening, he refused for a long time to tell his people to stand down, I would be very surprised if there are any criminal charges filed against any of them, just because, you know, the First Amendment is read so broadly in the context of political speech. And so, you know, I think this underscores the difference between, you know, formal criminal legal culpability and moral responsibility. Because, you know, to my mind, you know, people who fanned the flames and, you know, basically gave lighter fluid to a pyromaniac bear very clear moral responsibility. I just don't think that you'd be able to make a criminal case stick against them.
And again, I'm speaking with Eitan Goldman, who's a former federal prosecutor who serves as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York and helped build a case around the Oklahoma City bombing. He's currently a trial lawyer who focuses his practice on white-collar criminal defense, securities and commodities litigation, and complex commercial litigation. And he also served as director of the Division of Enforcement of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So what about people, though, below Trump himself? It does seem that Roger Stone played a role. There's growing evidence of that. He visited with Trump down in Mar-a-Lago a few days before the event. Alex Jones claims that he got $500,000 from the Trump administration to organize around the event. Stephen Bannon, on the day before the storming of the Capitol, said all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. And Roger Stone has been photographed with some of the Proud Boys. There was a Proud Boy demonstration down in Florida in front of Senator Rubio's house, at which the leader of the Proud Boys played over his phone to the crowd of Proud Boys a live commentary from Roger Stone urging them on. So is it, when you talk about conspiracy, is it possible that they may not be able to, well, they can hold Trump morally responsible, but not criminally responsible. Could they hold some of his sort of more bare-knuckles operatives like Roger Stone and Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn culpable?
The answer to that is it depends. I mean, I think that the department is taking a pretty conventional approach to the conspiracy cases here, where, you know, you often start with kind of the ground-level operatives, and you try to apply pressure and get them to flip on people above them. So you offer them better deals. You offer them less jail time if they will point the finger at somebody above them in the chain. And then you try to flip that person up above until you get, in the mafia context, to the boss, or, you know, in the white collar criminal context, to the CEO. And, you know, they will undoubtedly try to climb the chain there. Whether, you know, it gets to the Roger Stones of the world, it depends. I mean, if Roger Stone had organized rallies and protests around Rubio's house, and, you know, tried to get the Proud Boys in there to effectively get things more violent, that could get close to legal responsibility. I think that they would have to have someone in the Proud Boys who said, look, Roger Stone told us to storm the Capitol. He told us this is what Trump wanted. If they have something that is that clear, could they get Stone as part of a conspiracy case? Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if they have evidence that is that compelling against people like Stone.
Well, in terms of culpability, the acting Secretary of Defense actually went public just recently saying that Trump was culpable, but you know, that's a long way from him being held responsible under the law, I guess. As you pointed out, the First Amendment is broadly interpreted. But what about propaganda efforts underway by the Republicans in general to make this seem like it was no big deal? You've got Senator Ron Johnson basically saying that there are a bunch of Antifa and Black Lives Matter right. people, you know, in disguise. I mean, why would a bunch of Democrats assault the Capitol to overturn an election they won? I'm not sure of the logic of that, but what do you think of those efforts underway? Do you think they can actually change history and tell us that what we all saw live on television didn't really happen, with all those Trump flags and all of those chants, pro-Trump chants, and hang Mike Pence and assassinate Nancy Pelosi, all that stuff? It's seared into my memory. I don't know about yours, Zaytan.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something I won't forget. No, I certainly won't forget those people, you know, when they finally left the Capitol, walking out as, you know, free people and shouting into the camera, next time we're going to come back with guns. I mean, it is not something that you ever thought you'd see in the United States of America. In terms of whether or not that kind of propaganda works, unfortunately, there are people in this country and around the world who are pretty vulnerable to lies. And you can see, you know, more and more that people sometimes don't know who to believe. So there are going to be people who are predisposed to believe those lies and buy into it. But, you know, you see this every time there's some kind of heinous act. I mean, in, you know, Oklahoma City, I mean, the FBI caught who did it. And there are still people on the right wing in the militia movement who said this was a false flag operation. This was actually the government who did this on purpose in order to generate public sympathy so they could crack down on us and, you know, to support the assault ban, the assault rifle ban. Or you saw after 9/11, when it was clear that Al-Qaeda did it, you saw people saying, no, this was actually the Bush administration that did this in order to have a pretext to go into Afghanistan. So you always have these arguments by people who are radicalized and whose comrades do something repugnant and heinous to say, no, this wasn't really us. This was really the other side just trying to make us look bad. It's not true, but it gets said every time.
Well, just in closing then, isn't it important, though, to have public trials and to hold people accountable for what happened? This was an assault on American democracy itself, where the executive branch literally attacked the legislative branch. And it was clearly a coup attempt on the part of Donald Trump to overturn an election that he had lost. And it actually came close. So American democracy itself was put on trial. And isn't it important to set an example so that these people who consider themselves patriots can actually end up being convicted as murderous thugs and jailed as criminals?
I think it's critically important. I mean, you know, the historical comparisons, I mean, democracy is not a suicide pact, right? Democracies have the right to protect themselves. And, you know, the United States is not Weimar Germany, where there's, you know, some extremist party burns down the legislature and then uses that as a pretext to take power, right? I mean, look, I don't like comparisons to Hitler, but you saw that, right, there was a failed putsch in Weimar Germany, and Hitler and some people went to jail for a couple of years. I think that you need to punish people severely when they try to, you know, undermine the democratic system.
And what about the infamous defense of the Nazis? I was only following orders. Do you think some of these Trumpsters are going to try and pull that defense over their assault on the Capitol?
You do see that. I mean, you see people saying, oh, I thought I was doing what you know, Trump was telling me to. And I think that they're probably telling the truth. But, you know, that if that was an order, it wasn't a lawful order. You don't get to attack the foundation of a democratic country and then say, oh, but I was only doing that because, you know, the dictator told me to. Well, you made that decision.
Well, do you think that, just in closing, that there will be justice? You know, we start out talking about the person that you work for, Merrick Garland, on the Oklahoma City bombing case, now at the head of the Justice Department. I, for one, am crying out for justice because, first of all, I'm astounded that Trump has been one step ahead of the sheriff all of his life and has never been held to account for anything. And even if, as you say, he's not going to be held to account for this, you just feel like at some point or other, people can't sort of get away with this stuff, and particularly in the name of patriotism. It really is an insult to what American patriotism is about.
Yeah, I think under Judge Garland, the department will return to days where it followed the evidence and the law and brought cases without partisan fear or favor, and will, you know, get away from that hopefully brief aberration period where it was politicized and did things like, you know, file a new sentencing motion in the Roger Stone case or try to withdraw the guilty plea in the General Flynn case because those people were, you know, friends of Donald Trump and didn't throw him under the bus. So I am hopeful that with Merrick at the helm, you know, the department will, and Merrick's a law and order kind of guy. I don't think he is in any way soft on crime. So I think he will bring the cases, you know, that should be brought, and the kind of the politics be damned.
Well, Eytan Goldman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Eytan Goldman, who is a former federal prosecutor who served as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York and helped build the cases around the Oklahoma City bombing. He is currently a trial lawyer who focuses his practice on white-collar criminal defense, securities and commodities litigation, and complex commercial litigation. And he also serves as the director of the Division of Enforcement of the United States Commodities Futures Trading Commission. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining what Stacey Abrams calls the racist Republican voting suppression underway as Jim Crow in a suit and tie. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Engel.
Thank you, Ian.
So Stacey Abrams on CNN over the weekend described the voting suppression underway in the state of Georgia, where there was obviously an upset victory. Two Senate seats went to the Democrats, giving them control of the Senate. It seems as though the Republican response is, well, we've got to stop those people who voted to get the Democrats over the top. And she's referring to this activity as being racist and Jim Crow in a suit and tie. But similar activities are underway in Texas, where there are at least two dozen GOP-sponsored election bills under consideration in the Texas legislature, under the rubric, of course, of election integrity. But that doesn't fool anybody. It's straightforward voter suppression. So what are the chances of Governor Abbott and company succeeding in Texas?
Oh, it's a strong possibility, Ian. It's important not to overthink this. This is straight up rigging an election and rigging an election system, because they see that their grip on power is slipping away little by little. In Texas in 2020, we had a very smooth election, but it was the highest turnout election in recent Texas history. And that scared Greg Abbott and the Republicans to death. They saw that as you have higher turnout, we had more Latinos, more African-Americans, more people of color, and they did worse in the high turnout urban and suburban areas than they had done. Joe Biden got the highest vote total of any Democratic presidential candidate in recent memory, and got the highest percentage of any Democrat since Lyndon Johnson. And so the Republicans, they aren't going to waste any time. They're going to try to rig the system. It's a cheat to win approach. We're going to have to count on the courts and ideally the Congress and President Biden passing the John Lewis voting rights extension in order to stop what I think is a straight up election steal effort in Texas.
Well, the Democrats have already in the House have passed H.R. 1, and on the Sunday talk shows, Senator Cornyn of Texas referred to H.R. 1 as a power grab. And of course, its equivalent in the Senate, S.B. 1, would require getting over the threshold of the filibuster, which is literally impossible. You need 10 Republican senators to join in, and I don't think you'd be lucky to get one or two. Recently, I was told by a former Senate staffer that the list of the 10 most liberal senators on the Republican side in the Senate, Mitch McConnell is at number 7. So that gives you an idea. You're just never going to get anything past that filibuster threshold in the Senate, let alone SB1.
Well, I think that's right. And my view is that certainly they ought to eliminate the filibuster. If it ever had usefulness, it's lost. But they don't have to eliminate the filibuster altogether. I think that matters that go to fundamental constitutionally protected rights like voting are something that it would be absolutely appropriate to carve out an exception so that they could pass H.R. 1 and also pass H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Extension Act. This is about people's right to vote. It's absolutely fundamental to the well-being of our democracy. And so whether they waive the filibuster altogether or not, I think that there is certainly room to carve out a way to pass these essential voting rights bills. And you're going to see Republicans in Texas and across the country rig the system, change the rules. They consider a even playing field unfair to them. That's why John Cornyn said what he said about a power grab. Just the idea of there being fair and equal access to the ballot scares them to death. And so it's going to take Congress acting on a national scale in order to stop this effort in Texas and other places.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. And Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. But unfortunately, Matt, the rank and file of the Republican Party have been conditioned to believe in this notion of you need election integrity because the last election was stolen. Obviously, they are believing Donald Trump's campaign of Stop the Steal. And according to a recent Quinnipiac University poll, 3 out of every 4 Republicans believe that there was widespread voter fraud in last year's election. So how do you get over that?
Well, to begin with, I don't think that that's really a sincerely held belief. I think that that provides a little escape hatch for people to hide their true feelings about race, quite frankly, and about white supremacy and about authoritarianism. I think this is the Republicans giving their rank and file an excuse other than to say that they're scared to death of the changing electorate in Texas. And so I think we have to just, as the slogan of the Lone Star Project is, we have to fight back with facts. We have to tell the truth relentlessly, and we have to let facts prevail. We shouldn't be buffaloed into taking actions based on people believing things or saying that they believe things that simply aren't true.
Well, in terms of voter fraud, the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, who himself, of course, wears his Christian beliefs on his sleeve, he advertised himself as a Christian family values type. But nevertheless, he's being investigated by the FBI for paying off a mistress to keep her silent. And ever since he's been in office, he's been under the cloud of securities fraud indictment and investigation. So nevertheless, Ken Paxton's office spent 22,000 hours looking for voter fraud, and they only uncovered 16 cases of false addresses on registration forms out of what nearly 17 million voters who are registered in Texas. So that tells you that this whole election integrity scam is a total fraud. Can you shame them in with the facts on that, Matt?
No, you can't shame them. They're shameless. The voter fraud effort in Texas, the phony effort to uncover non-existent voter fraud, really was launched by Greg Abbott, the current governor of Texas, way back in 2006. Ken Paxton just corruptly picked up the mantle that Abbott laid for him. What we're going to have to do is make sure that the public and the courts are have demonstrated to them that voter fraud is a myth. Any cliche you can think of, you're more likely to be struck by lightning, you're more likely to win the lottery two times in a row. All those things are much more likely than there to be intentional voter fraud. And the whole notion that we've had millions and millions of dollars of taxpayer money spent looking for something that they know is not there is an outrage. And I don't think, again, we need to be buffaloed or intimidated by people promoting things as truth that are simply false.
Well, it's pretty clear that following the ice storms that paralyzed Texas, and they had massive blackouts and the water pipes froze and people's homes were damaged, and then they got massive electric bills, and clearly Abbott and the lieutenant governor and Paxton, that kind of triumvirate, you know, they'd prefer to talk about transgender bathrooms than the nuts and bolts of governance. And they clearly failed at the nuts and bolts of governance. But immediately thereafter, they've been throwing out a lot of things to distract the voters in Texas, particularly pandering to the Trump base over opening up and not wearing masks, etc. So is this an extension of that effort on Abbott's part to basically distract the voters? Because, I mean, surely he must be feeling some heat from the average citizens down there, because clearly their government failed them.
Well, he definitely is. In fact, Abbott has probably taken more negative speculation real criticism over the last year and any time in his career, and certainly since the ice storm in Texas. Abbott entirely bungled the pandemic in Texas. 50,000 Texans have died, a higher percentage of the deaths than we are of the country in terms of population. Texas is among the slowest and least efficient in getting vaccines. That's all on Greg Abbott. And then, of course, we had the ice storm, in which you had literally millions of Texans who were freezing in their own homes, then went without water, and really suffered. And I'm literally, we're talking about millions of Texans. It turns out that Greg Abbott all along had not provided any oversight of the Texas Utility Commission, which had allowed the utility companies to not update, not winterize. So all of this can be laid at Greg Abbott's feet. He's desperate to change the subject He's trying to throw red meat to his base. He's even a little bit worried about a primary challenge in his own party. So a lot of this is about distraction. But don't think that they're not serious about it, Ian. If they intend to vote to pass these voter suppression laws. And we're going to have to really spend the legislative session building the legal record against it and then really putting the pressure on Congress and the president to go ahead and pass the John Lewis voting rights extension law.
Well, when you mentioned, Matt Engel, that you can't shame the shameless, is there a distinction between the rank and file of the Republican Party and the kind of professional Republican politicians that you have in Washington and that you also have in the Texas legislature, the ones that keep throwing out red meat and extraneous issues, you know, culture war issues like transgender bathrooms and stuff? That seems to be the way they operate. And I'm wondering if there's any difference, because the way that the modern Republican Party, particularly in the House, and remember the most recent freshman crop of Republican lawmakers in the House are amongst the most extreme ever. And if that's the trajectory they're on, you're going to have more Lauren Boberts and Marjorie Taylor Greene types being elected to the Republican caucus in the House and Senate. So it's not a very promising picture here, because this is a party that seems to have disregard or even contempt for democracy. They seem to be heading in a completely authoritarian direction, and they are no longer have any principles. They only are interested in power. This is really, in terms of American democracy, this is a really bad situation, and it's getting worse.
It's a terrible threat to our democracy and to the Constitution itself. I mean, so-called moderates and then the Trumpers or the extremists on the right wing among Republicans is a distinction without a difference right now. That, in fact, I think a lot of it's calculated. John Cornyn in Texas is a perfect example. He is by mannerisms, by style, much more even-keeled. But on anything that matters, when push comes to shove, that he's going to line up right there with the most extreme members of the Texas Republican Party, whether it's our wacky, irresponsible Republican Party chair, Alan West, or the more extreme members of Congress like Louie Gohmert. On anything that really matters, John Cornyn and the others that like to present themselves as more fair-minded, they're right there. And so they don't get any credit for style. It's substance that matters, and they're wrong in the substance across the board.
Well, but in terms of naming and shaming, do you think it's possible to somehow point out to the American people, and not just the Democrats, but to the broader electorate, because I think there are more independents in this country than there are Democrats and Republicans, that one of the two American parties, the Republican Party, basically no longer believes in democracy? That ought to be a pretty serious indictment.
I absolutely agree. And I actually think that people are starting to get the joke on that, that there are more independent or what I call unaligned voters than there are Democrats or Republicans. And I think that number is increasing because people are leaving the Republican Party and not identifying as Republicans. It's happening formally in states that register by party, and it's happening informally in places like Texas, where we have an opportunity to reach out to some fair-minded people who have in the past defaulted to Republicans, who are now starting to see them as not patriotic and not caring about their country, only caring about themselves. I mean, the party that tried to present itself for a generation as the party of law and order and the party of the flag and of country now is the party that breaks the laws, cheats to win, wants to change the laws to protect their power, then disrespect the Constitution to the point of really threatening our democracy. And so I think we have a lot of work to do, but I think that message is starting to sink in.
And it's also Republicans acting in Trump's name and storming the Capitol on January the 6th, killed Capitol Hill policemen. So they can't claim to be the party of law and order when they're ardent followers of Trump are now being arrested for killing Officer Brian Sitnik.
Absolutely. And, you know, Texans know to a greater degree than I have seen in the past Ted Cruz's own culpability in that circumstance. Some of those writers not only called Trump's name, but they also cited Ted Cruz as somebody who would be approving of what they're doing and somebody who was and who helped incite them. And then you follow that up with Cruz's infamous trip to Cancun in the middle of the ice storm. And so I think you are starting to see voters who normally don't think about politics on a day-to-day basis realizing that you've got Republicans that aren't just corrupt from the standpoint of breaking the law, but corrupt in their very approach to politics, and that they would undermine democracy in order to protect their own power.
Well, Matt Engel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. And Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the Protecting the Rights to Organize PRO Act and how it impacts efforts underway to unionize the anti-union behemoth Amazon, and how Americans like unions, but only 10.7% of the workforce, belong to them.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood, mistakes of the bosses.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lane Wyndham, who is the Associate Director of Georgetown University's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and co-director of Will Empower, that's Women's Innovating Labor Leadership. And she's the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s, and The Roots of a New Economic Divide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lane Wyndham.
I'm pleased to be here with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I wanted to talk to you about the PRO Act, which passed last week in the House and is in the Senate, of course, facing a filibuster, the Protecting the Right to Organize, PRO Act. And I'm wondering about whether or not this goes back to when Obama was first elected with the economy in free fall. He obviously was trying to get, because he actually genuinely believed in bipartisanship, he was trying to get Republican support for the bailout of Wall Street, etc., and get his agenda through. But he narrowed his agenda largely to the Affordable Care Act. And one of the important labor issues that were on the table then, the Employee Free Choice Act, he didn't push that when he had actually a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, the Democrats had. So did Joe Biden learn from that? The assumption is that he learned from Obama's mistakes of trying to reach out for bipartisanship with the Republicans, because none of them voted eventually for the $800 billion stimulus bill, which was half as big as it should have been had he not been strung along by the Republicans. And of course, the irony is that it took the recovery much longer, and Donald Trump, of all people, was able to take credit for the recovery. So in terms of the Employee Free Choice Act, do you think Biden learned his lesson there and is therefore going to push the PRO Act?
So I definitely think that President Biden has clearly prioritized workers' freedom to form unions. You know, the fact that the PRO Act is coming up so quickly in his administration is definitely a contrast to what we saw under Obama. But of course, you know, labor law reform has come up numerous times. It came up in 2007 as well as in 1978. What I see is really different this time is President Biden is being very vocally supportive of workers' freedom to form unions. He issued that video message being very clear that when it comes to forming a union, voting on a union, that it is the worker's choice, not the employer. That statement was the strongest pro-union statement or strongest statement in support of workers' freedom to form unions really since Roosevelt passed the National Labor Relations Act in 1935.
And of course, it's coming out at a time when there's a critical vote down at a Amazon facility in Alabama, where 6,000 workers are trying to unionize, and no company is more anti-union, I think, than Amazon. The employees are constantly propagandized against unions. Even when you go to the bathroom, in the privacy of a bathroom at an Amazon facility, you have propaganda on the walls telling you not to join a union. So do you think that Biden's statements in any way embolden the efforts to unionize in Bessemer, Alabama?
I hope so. You know, the workers in Bessemer had actually been voting since the beginning of the month, and so many of them may have already mailed their ballots by the time that Biden's video message came out. But you are absolutely right that Amazon is doing the kinds of things we often see employers do to stop workers from organizing. They're holding mandatory closed-door meetings. The union is prohibited from attending where the company talks against the union. They're telling workers they'll have to pay dues. That's not true. Those flyers and the bathroom stalls, right? And then workers report that that their supervisors are constantly coming up to them at their work areas, their workstations, and talking to them about the union. And, you know, this is what we see employers do all the time. A recent study by the Economic Policy Institute shows that about 42% of employers break the law during organizing campaigns. About a third actually threaten or coerce workers.
And again, I'm speaking with Lane Windham, who's the Associate Director of Georgetown University's Kanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and co-director of Will Empower, that's Women Innovating Labor Leadership. She is the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s, and The Roots of a New Economic Divide. And it looks though as though the new Secretary of the Labor, Marty Walsh, who used to head the Building and Trade Union Federation in Boston, he later became the mayor of Boston, of course. So that's a good sign, surely. And on the first day in office, President Biden fired Peter Robb, the National Labor Relations Board's general counsel, who apparently has always been virulently anti-union. So are those good signs?
Yes, I definitely think so. I mean, the National Labor Relations Board, in many ways, the administration in power has a lot of leeway to basically make appointments, and President Biden can make sure that that is an agency which supports workers' freedom to form unions, and I think he's definitely stepping in that direction.
So why is it that the U.S. is the one of the least unionized countries of the advanced democracies, and particularly those that have social democracy, like the European and the Scandinavian countries? And in Germany, for example, it's the law that all the big corporations have to have, I think, about half of the members of the board of directors representing unions and representing labor. And in 2017, only 10.7% of all Americans belong to a union. But nevertheless, in a Gallup poll in 2020, found that 65% of Americans approved of unions, and that's up from 48% in 2010. So you have that disconnect. You have low union membership, but high approval of unions in this country. So explain that to us, if you will.
That's exactly right. And I'll give you one more statistic, which is that half of workers who do not, U.S. workers who do not currently have a union, say that they would form a union tomorrow if given the chance. Yet, we're only at about a little over 10% of the workers have a union, right? So, you know, the question that you ask, why is the U.S. so different than other countries, is one that historians have discussed ad nauseum. There have been many books written on this. I believe that it is because in the U.S., corporations have long had an outsized power. And I mean from the beginning of corporations from the 1870s, 1880s. Corporations have had more sway in the United States in terms of public policy, in terms of government. In many ways, we had national corporations in this country before we had a social safety net, before we had a lot of the federal kinds of programs. And so what we have found is that corporations have resisted workers forming unions decade after decade after decade. And the U.S. government has done too little to shore up workers' freedom to have unions. Of course, you did have the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, but employers, especially starting in the 1970s, began to bend and break labor law at such a level that that law has virtually become meaningless. And today, workers really need to have those rights shored up.
So, Lane, in terms of the work that you're doing on labor and the history of labor here in the United States and labor organizing, is the decline in unions reflected in the growing inequality in this country?
Absolutely. You know, the basically, as union membership drops in this country over the last six decades, the gap between the wealthy and the rest of the country has grown. You know, union contracts close that divide. Union workers make about 22% more than workers who don't have a union. They're much more likely to have employer-provided health care and benefits. And unions just mean more security, which is especially interesting to people when so much of the job market today is so turbulent. Unions, not only that, but they also help close the wage gap that is there in terms of race and gender. So unions definitely address inequality.
So let's talk a little then, Lane Wyndham, about the PRO Act, Protecting the Rights to Organize, which passed the House last week on Tuesday evening and is headed for the Senate, where it will face a filibuster for sure. And that raises questions about whether or not the Democrats' priority should be to get rid of the filibuster, which we can certainly talk about. But let's talk a little bit about what the PRO Act does. Much of what we've been talking about, the activities of Amazon propagandizing their workers, that would end, would it not? The PRO Act bans those kind of meetings, doesn't it?
That's right. The PRO Act would ban the one-sided forced attendance meetings. They're often called captive audience meetings because the employer makes workers go to these and the union is not even allowed in the room. The PRO Act would prohibit those. You know, it would also, when employers break the law right now, let's say that an employer is found guilty of breaking the law. There are no penalties, none, right? The most that the employer has to do is hang a blue and white sign in the break room that says, hey, we broke the law. The PRO Act would say if a company illegally fires someone, the government has to step in and take steps to help get them back to work immediately. And that there would be actual penalties, not only for the company, but the individual bosses who break the law could also be held individually liable. There's lots of things the PRO Act does too. You know, it prevents a company from calling someone an independent contractor or a supervisor just so they can get around labor law and keep those workers from forming unions. It would also determine that, hey, lots of workers today have more than one employer, right? It would sort of solidify the joint employer standard so that employers can't say, oh, well, yeah, I set that person's schedule or I set terms of their employment, but I'm not really their boss, right? They can't organize a union in my workplace because they're not really my workers. It would close all those kinds of loopholes.
So, well, here in California, of course, we had a referendum that was financed by Uber and Lyft that unfortunately the majority of voters in California voted for it. And of course, they're talking about the gig economy and the idea that you're your own boss and all that nonsense, that delusion that somehow you're independent, but you don't get any any rights, any benefits, any health care coverage, any pensions, anything. I mean, that this is the story, isn't it, Lane? Workers used to have pensions. They're essentially being gutted, put into the private sector in the form of 401ks, etc. The story has been a long decline in both workers' rights, workers' income, and workers' benefits. But could it be turned around with Biden, who apparently says he's going to be the most pro-union president we've had for some time?
I think that Biden is one piece and that will certainly help. I also think that what we're seeing among workers are going to have to lead a new movement for collective action and standing up for their rights. We have seen a surge of interest in unions over the last several years. I'm thinking of the Red for Ed strikes. You know, there were more strikes in 2019 in the U.S. than we've seen since the early 1980s. And so I think that, yes, certainly the support from the government will make all the difference. And working people are going to have to continue on a larger scale to stand up and demand their rights.
So what about fighting for workers' rights at the Supreme Court level, because the Republicans obviously dominate the Supreme Court, particularly now with Trump having put three conservatives on the court, all chosen by the Federalist Society. And Gorsuch, the first one that he got on the court, literally advertised himself as being anti-labor with the so-called frozen truck driver case, where he was the only judge to rule on this panel, suggesting that a truck driver whose rig broke down in the dead of winter in a blizzard should have stayed with his rig and froze to death instead, rather than abandon the rig to go to get help. So that's the mentality. And they don't, when the Senate goes through the confirmation hearings, they never talk about, ask these candidates whether they're corporatists and anti-union, which has certainly been the case with Gorsuch and his the other two as well. So the idea that they don't have to pay union dues, which is one of the cases here in California, that's I don't know where it stands in terms of the Supreme Court, the Free Riders Bill, I guess it's called. What's happening at that level, in other words, to somehow curb the anti-union bias on the Supreme Court and in the judiciary in general?
Right. So, you know, the Supreme Court, and you're absolutely right to say the federal judiciary, because the Trump administration was able to basically pack the courts. And that is going to influence workers and class-based issues really for a generation. You know, we've certainly seen in this country where the courts have been one of the most anti-labor institutions, that I'm thinking all the way, you know, from the beginning of the 20th century, when injunctions were used against strikers over and over again, until the Wagner Act was passed in 1935. And so it may very well be that, again, that Congress is going to have to pass laws that make clear workers' rights and go around the judiciary when possible, because I don't think that we can count on the judicial branch to, you know, in pockets, in some places, in some areas of the country, they will uphold workers' rights, but in many places they won't.
Well, Lane Windham, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's good to chat.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Lane Windham, who's the Associate Director of Georgetown University's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and co-director of Will Empower, that's Women Innovating Labor Leadership. And she is the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s, and The Roots of a New Economic Divide. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. and to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.